from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, Tahoe novelist Todd Borg and his series of mysteries with the famous lake as a backdrop. Also, author Anita Jain, who was raised in Sacramento but lives in Delhi. Her new book is about going back to her Indian roots for a more traditional way to find a husband. And why camels race every year in Virginia City. But first, it's the time of year when freshmen settle in or prepare to settle into college life. Behind them is another wave of high school students trying to figure out which university they'd like to go to next year. A local management professor has ideas to help, and he's written a book about it called The College Journey. He's Richard Dorff, and he's Professor Emeritus at the UC Davis Graduate School of Management. Richard Dorff, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be with you.
How do you start the process of figuring out which is the school for you?
Well, you get together with your family. That's the best way. It's just the product of the best product comes out of a good chat with your family about resources, location. What are your goals? And you know, those come in good chats. Try to figure out what your goals are for college, and of course, the parents' goals and the student goals.
A lot of students are looking forward, at least in part, to getting away from their family when they go to school. How would the chat with the family help you decide which school to go to?
Well, assuming your relationship with your family is good, I think it can be a valuable discussion. If that's not the best, then how about some good friends? Perhaps people who went to college last year, some people you know from the class ahead of you. The main thing would be to talk to someone, perhaps a good friend, a teacher at school. So if it's not the family, it could be a teacher. But the main goal there, or the main outcome of that little chat, the first step, is to talk about goals.
My guest is Richard Dorff, author of The College Journey, From College to Career 2009. I know a lot of people decide what they want to study and then look for the university that is conveniently located, affordably priced, and that specializes perhaps in that subject. Is there a case to be made for finding the right school for you and then backing into the subject?
Well, there are some people, some students who are convinced that they know the major that they're going to take and that they're already mentally and emotionally on that track. For them, yes, they could start talking with people who are knowledgeable, and they should start thinking about that. On the other hand, probably a majority of the students, or would-be, you know, college students, have some ideas, but those are subject to change, and they probably have an open mind and want to hear some options for them, some different versions of what might be good for them. As you noted, some of the issues, cost, mm-hmm. location, quality of program. But one of the things that students don't think about, and even parents, is that there are arguably maybe 8 to 10 types of colleges that you need to consider, and what kind of college will fit your goals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good, important issue, setting aside the cost issues and location.
Your book includes what's described as an algorithm to help people figure out what kind of school to go to. And a lot of people think of an algorithm first and foremost as something that's used in mathematics or in computing. In this context, what is an algorithm?
Yes, well, that's a term that we put in the release, you know, for about the book. In the book, I call it a method, but whatever you want to call it, an algorithm or a method, it does help you to put down on paper some format, you know, follow my format, and that'll take you through the issues that you need to go through. Then you could go through around this analysis method subsequently, maybe a month from now, and try again, see if you have a different set of answers.
You said,
I know from my grandson who's in that spot, you know, he has different answers every time I talk to him. So he may has the same general goals, but where they'll actually come through is, you know, subject to movement and reflection.
You said go through the issues.
The book is really trying to find the best college and then be successful there.
Yeah.
So the real issue is finding a college where you can be successful.
You said go through the issues. What kind of issues should you go through when you're trying to determine what university to go to?
Well, first of all, a simple way of putting it is look at your own character. What are your goals? What are your strengths? What really interests you at this point? Now, we recognize that, we all recognize that maybe at this point when you're 17 years old, it might change by the time you're 20. But then you also look at your situation. What are your financial resources and how far are you able to travel? What types of schools would fit you then? Are you self-starter? Are you a high achiever? Ask yourself that. Or perhaps you're an average student. That's still good. You can be very successful and be an average student if you choose the right college.
Yeah.
So we try to address all those issues. I know there are a lot of issues. The book is actually written for the parents as well as the student, because I do think the parents or grandparents, whoever helping the student.
How important are the rankings that you find of universities in magazines like U.S. News and World Report? Is that part of the research process, in your opinion, a good part of the process in determining what school to apply to?
No, I think it's overdone. Too much frantic effort over rankings. Not enough over whether the school is the right one for you personally. I mean, I don't care. I mean, I'll take Princeton or Harvard and call them number one if you want, but that's number one for a set of people. That's certainly not one for everybody. Number one for everybody.
I see.
Yeah, no, it'd be Sacramento State, where you're at least physically located. I don't know if you're part of Sac State, but anyway, you're located there. Definitely is a school for a set of students. I mean, and I don't think the best place for them is Harvard. They would be very discouraged at Harvard, you know, with all these super achievers.
My guest is Richard Dorfey, author of The College Journey, From College to Career 2009. It's a book that helps guide people through the process of deciding which school to apply to. He's also Professor Emeritus of the UC Davis Graduate School of Management. He is also Professor Emeritus of Electrical and Computer Engineering. Now, you went to several schools when you were a student. How did you decide which to go to?
Yes, well, that's very difficult. I must admit that was a long time ago. But for me, it was really, I used this method, I suppose. I tried to talk to people about the strengths and weaknesses that I had. Then I put those strengths and weaknesses, identified those, and then tried to determine a college that fit me. In other words, a college where I would be a student in the middle of the pack. That is, I would be comfortable with the level of the demands. I went to an engineering college, of course, then. In that array that I was looking at was MIT. I went to Clarkson, and RPI was another one. Those were all what we call specialized colleges. Those all are now. Those, in other words, were engineering colleges primarily. You could also study engineering at Columbia, where I grew up in New York City, but I didn't want to stay in New York. So in other words, you put these characteristics that you have, and you look at the characteristics of the school. Hopefully you visit them, if that isn't too difficult. And you visit them, you talk to some students there. I really recommend that you talk to some students. Don't just take the tour.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to some students, find out what life is like there. Visit the dining rooms. See how students are getting along. Is there a good atmosphere? If it's a commuter college, you can still talk to commuters.
Yeah.
You know.
You visited more than 150 colleges and universities when you were working on the book. Did you visit any schools where you thought, my goodness, I wish I was a young man because this is the school that I would go to now?
Well, there are some schools that I'm highly impressed on with, yes, that I feel have come a long way and serve a need. But let's stick sort of to California, since California is the, where we are here, and we've been making this broadcast. I would say that if you looked here at how the Pomona colleges have come, they've emerged from 25 or 30 years ago being quite good and well-recognized, but today they're an outstanding conglomerate of colleges. Of course, it's expensive, but if you can afford that, that's very attractive. If you're an very excited engineering student, there's some wonderful engineering colleges in the state. If you're a liberal arts, there are some great liberal arts colleges in Oregon, in California. So you ask yourself, what type of college fits? I try to describe the, in the book, I do describe the types that I assign, which are liberal arts colleges, comprehensive universities, specialized colleges like engineering colleges, community college, research university, that's us at UC Davis, for-profit university, which, of course, we have several in Sacramento, and the elite university, which is Stanford and Princeton and Harvard.
Yes. What if you go through the book and decide this is the school I want to go to, and you apply, but they don't accept you?
That's highly unlikely in using my scheme, because you can use a scheme where you have one reach school. In other words, let's say you're an average student and you went to, say, Rio Americana, and you're an average student, and meaning you have like a B+, and maybe a GPA of 3.5, and you have an SAT in the reasonable category, let's say 1170. If you have that, you're an average student, or you're good, but you'd be an average college student. You might be able to be admitted to UC Davis. You could be perhaps admitted to, certainly to Sac State, UOP. There's some wonderful schools, University of Southern California. You could go on to Santa Clara University. So those schools, to me, are, all those schools that I just mentioned, are well worth attending and first class. I think we have a lot of sort of first class universities in California.
So the key is getting decent grades and really figuring out which is the best school for you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Richard Dorff, author of The College Journey, From College to Career 2009, also professor emeritus of the UC Davis Graduate School of Management. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
By the way, the latest issue of U.S. News and World Report has its 25th annual ranking of America's best colleges. I scanned it for universities in our area. UC Davis is number 44 in the list of so-called national universities, and University of the Pacific number 102. UC Davis was ranked number 12 on the list of the top public national universities. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Tahoe novelist Todd Borg and author Anita Jain, who was raised in Sacramento but lives in Delhi. Her new book is about going back to her Indian roots for a more traditional way to find a husband. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. Developing a prominent empty site near Capital City Freeway has proven impossible for many. Tomorrow in Insight, Phil Angelides tells you why he wants to try. You'll also hear from a neighborhood group that kept the last development from happening. That and much more tomorrow on Insight. Tahoe is the spectacular backdrop for a series of mystery novels starring private detective Owen McKenna. The book's author, Todd Borg, knows Tahoe well. He's lived at the famous lake for nearly 20 years. Borg's sixth McKenna mystery is just out. It's called Tahoe Avalanche. Todd's come down the hill to our studio. Todd Borg, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
Why did you decide to set a series of mystery novels in Lake Tahoe? Or rather, why did you decide to set the first one in Lake Tahoe?
Well, you know, when we first moved there in 1990, looking at the landscape was so impressive. The landscape is so large, the lake and the mountains, that it struck me immediately that it would be a very good setting for a series where the landscape would actually almost be a character. And so in the books, many of the scenes are set outdoors, and you get a real strong sense of what that landscape is like. And the weather also, because as you know, when the weather comes to Tahoe, it's serious.
Owen McKenna is a former homicide detective from San Francisco. Why did he move up to Tahoe?
Owen McKenna's backstory is that he was on the San Francisco Police Department for 20 years when he had experienced an incident that gave him one of those moments where he thought, you know what, I'm going to reevaluate my life and what I'm doing. And so without actually saying what that incident is, you find out about it in the books. He decided to leave the force and become a private investigator, partly because he was in law enforcement and he wanted to stay with his expertise, but also partly because he thought it would be a more genteel way to earn a living, which, of course, didn't turn out to be the case. So he moved up to Tahoe, and that's where he's been ever since.
You moved to Tahoe from somewhere else, not from San Francisco, from the other direction. Why did you move to Tahoe?
My wife and I were from the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And like many people, we had taken several vacations to Tahoe, one too many, in fact. And we decided, you know, we'd really like to live in a place with this kind of a landscape and this kind of a climate. The climate's spectacular. And so we just made the decision one day, there's never going to be a good time to move, so let's just move. So we sold everything and headed west.
Wow. Now, Minnesota has quite a lot of lakes, too.
Minnesota has a lot of lakes. It's a very pretty state. It's somewhat of a flat state, and the lakes are somewhat small. And so the contrast with Tahoe is major. And coming to Tahoe was one of those experiences that it was a big eye-opener, what kind of a landscape is available out there to live in. So we headed west, and partly because we wanted to be near the other things that are in Northern California. Sacramento and the Bay Area, of course, are powerful attractions.
Todd Borg, author, lives in the Lake Tahoe area, which he uses as the backdrop to a series of mystery novels. The latest, Tahoe Avalanche, was published last month. You were not a published novelist at the time when you moved here. What did you plan to do, you and your wife, when you moved to Tahoe? How did you make it work?
We had been in the picture framing business in Minnesota. And so when we came to Tahoe, we started another picture framing business. And after 27 years, we decided just 2.5 years ago to sell so that I could write full-time and my wife could paint full-time. But while we were framing in Tahoe, I started writing in earnest.
Wow. And was that in the back of your mind when you and your wife decided to move out to Tahoe, that at some point in your future you'd be doing something different, something like writing novels?
Well, I had written several novels when we lived in Minnesota. And those novels are sitting in drawers as we speak. But I had always wanted to pursue writing. It seemed like the most marvelous way to spend your time. You know, some people look at a novel and they think, well, this would be really a complex project to undertake. You know, how would you do such a thing? And I look at it and I think, well, it's a little complex, but compared to getting up and going to work at a job every day, you know, it's kind of a dream life. You know, you make a big pot of coffee and you sit down in a little room and you make up a bunch of stuff, and that's quite a living.
What was it like the last day with the picture framing business when you realized that this source of income for you and your wife was about to go away and you were going to become a novelist? Did you second guess yourself?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, it was a little scary. You sort of wonder if this is the stupidest thing you're ever doing, selling your main income. But I couldn't be happier. The books are going very well, and I'm delighted that I gave it a shot. So I intended to continue with this. I really enjoy it.
Well, what was the first day like as the novelist?
I did like I just referred to. I got up, made a big pot of coffee, and sat down at the computer and made up some more stuff, told some more stories. Yeah.
How do you structure your days writing? Because that's a challenge for lots of people who like to be a published author, but it's figuring out how you're going to produce enough material every day and how much counts as enough material.
Well, you know, I'm not one of those writers who has a daily structure. I don't get up at 5 and write for 4 hours every day, anything like that. You have to, of course, be disciplined to turn out novels. There's an enormous amount of time involved in writing and editing and rewriting and re-editing, etc. So I have the discipline to do it, but I don't operate within a structure. Each day is a little different. One day I'll be doing a book signing here. Another day I'll be doing a talk someplace else. Then I wake up at 3 in the morning and I can't sleep, and I think this is a good time to write, squeeze in a little here and there. And so you kind of, you know, fit it in wherever you can. If I'm driving and I get an idea, you know, I know I shouldn't do this, but I pull out a Post-it note and stick it on the steering wheel and, you know, and write down my ideas as I'm going.
So you don't have an allotment of words that you need to get through every day?
No. Some writers do, but I don't. I don't work within that kind of a structure very well.
How do you set about creating your stories? Do they just emerge as you start typing? Or do you plot out the whole story and then the writing of the novel is basically filling in the gaps?
I think I'm like a lot of writers in that I start out with an outline, maybe 15 pages long. And this gives me the basic premise of the book and the central conflict, the main characters, and what kind of a climax it's going to build to. But I quickly tend to veer away from that. It's kind of like, I think working from an outline is a little bit like planning a road trip. You get out your maps and you've decided you're going to go from Sacramento to New York and maybe take Highway 50. My problem is I get to that first intersection in the middle of Nevada, and instead of going straight, I think it looks a lot more interesting to the left. So I abandon my map and my plans and go a whole different direction. Eventually, I usually come back to the place that I plan to at the end of the book. I usually bring that climax back over the Hudson River and into downtown New York if that's my plan. But how I get there really changes. It veers away from my intentions. And I end up writing many outlines as I go along as a result.
What happens if you discover in the course of writing the book that where you thought the story was going to end up is not where it ends up? Surely, with a mystery, you're left with the problem of threads being pulled out of the rug, and before you know it, it's all been pulled away.
That's exactly what happens. And yes, it's a real problem. Then you have to go back and restructure and figure out how you're going to pull these loose ends together, and then you rewrite, and it can be quite a trick.
I can imagine for mystery writers, it could be a little worrying when the book gets out and you know that your fans are reading it and they spot a weak spot in the story, you know, where some two things don't connect. Do you worry about that when the book goes out, that you've missed something? Because, I mean, I'm guessing you must go over it logically pretty closely since it's a mystery novel and it needs to make sense.
Yeah, I reread it many, many times. My wife, who is my primary first editor and my last editor, reads it several times. I also have four other people who are very perceptive, and they go through.
Who are they?
Well,
you don't have to name them, but how did you come upon them?
A couple are English majors. One's an attorney, a former prosecutor, smart people who know the ins and outs of both books and how to construct a decent sentence. So they do a very good job of catching my loose ends, the things that I missed, little plot problems, that kind of thing. And they also do a good job of catching, you know, the typos and that sort of thing, too. So I'm very fortunate that way. Of course, some mistakes do get through. And yes, once in a while, a reader will write me and say, you know, you said alter when you meant alter. There's two different, you know, spellings. And of course, spell check doesn't catch those things. And we tend to, writers tend to flatter ourselves when, after all of the editing process goes through and mistakes still get through, we tend to say, oh, well, of course, they were so tuned into the story that they never even noticed the writing, and boy, it must really be working, you know, that kind of thing.
Lake Tahoe-based author Todd Borg's new novel is called Tahoe Avalanche. It's the sixth in a series of mystery novels starring the private detective Owen McKenna. The books have Lake Tahoe as the backdrop. The titles of all of the books start with Tahoe.
Yes.
Do you get worried about running out of nouns to follow Tahoe that will sound good as a title?
There are probably an infinite number of combinations that might work. But yeah, I kind of wonder about it. I sometimes, when I come up with an idea for another book, I think, well, what in the world's going to be the title of this one? And it's a question. But when you do a series, it's very helpful, as you know, to have a series identifier in the title. And so there are people who will discover my book. I'll get an email from someone and say, yeah, I found your book in my bookstore in Philadelphia, and maybe a year or two from now, that person won't remember what my name is. But when they go to find out about my new book and they decide to Google me, they'll type in, oh yeah, Tahoe Mysteries, that kind of thing, and up pops the book. So the identifier works really well, and it's worth whatever is the downside in trying to find the next set of titles.
Where does the title come in the process? Do you start with a title and that inspires the basic story, or do you write the story and then go, well, this is Tahoe Avalanche?
The title, I think, comes really late in the process. Typically, I think I'm like a lot of writers in that we have many more ideas than we could ever turn into books. And for me, I use what I think of as a what-if scenario. I think of it a concept, and then I change it a little bit and say to myself, what if? So, for example, on the book that came out last year, Tahoe Silence, I had heard, I believe, on NPR a story about autism. And as you know, of course, many times because autistic kids have trouble communicating, they sometimes are misdiagnosed and sometimes they are thought to have not as much mental activity going on as they maybe really do, but we can't tell because we can't communicate them. So my what-if scenario with that was, what if there was a 17-year-old girl who couldn't speak? In fact, the communication part of her brain isn't working at all. She can't use sign language. She can't write. Hence her nickname, Silence. And then I thought, oh, well, there's my title, Tahoe Silence. But the what-if scenario is a very good way to come up with an idea. And I took that concept and went one notch further and said, what if this girl has a priceless secret and she's kidnapped for that secret because the kidnapper thinks he can make a fortune with it? But of course, being unable to communicate, she can't say what it is. And so the idea and the title and it all just came together all in one.
Well, you mentioned Silence, and that leads me to this question. That woman, Silence Ramirez, and there's also in Tahoe Avalanche, March Carrera. These are very colorful names. How do you come up with them?
When you're looking at names in a mystery, there's a couple of things you need to consider. One is the character a sympathetic character? Are they a person that no one would mind having the same name with? Or are they a really notorious bad guy and do bad things, in which case then maybe you would have to wonder, what if somebody else shares this name? How are they going to think? Go think about it. So there's two approaches. You can come up with a very unusual name that perhaps no one else in the country has. Silence Ramirez might be a singular name. The other approach is you can name your character Bob Smith, and that way, whether it's a good guy or a bad guy, you don't have to worry that someone's going to say, wait a second, you named a character after me and made me look bad, that kind of thing. I tend to lean toward the colorful names. I think it adds a little bit more interest, and it's easier to kind of engage the reader if they pick up a book and they're reading about someone named Silence. Or in fact, for example, Owen McKenna's girlfriend is named Street Casey in the book. Street's a forensic entomologist. She's very important. She was named Street because her parents didn't get to the hospital in time. When she was born in the street. And so that becomes a much more memorable thing for readers than the Bob Smiths of the name world.
Yes. Todd Borg is an author who lives in the Lake Tahoe area, which he uses as the backdrop to a series of six mystery novels, the Owen McKenna Mysteries. The latest, Tahoe Avalanche, was published last month. Upcoming book signings include this Saturday and Sunday at the Lake Tahoe Food and Wine Festival at North Star Village. Todd Borg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I had a good time.
This is Insight. Author and journalist Anita Jain was born in India but raised all over the U.S., including many years in Sacramento. She now lives in Delhi but is back in town visiting her parents. Jain's new book, Marrying Anita, is about her search for a husband using more traditional methods in India. The book was reviewed in Sunday's New York Times. Anita Jain, welcome to Insight.
Hi. Thanks, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
You were raised in the U.S. Why did you decide to look for a husband in India?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was dating in New York and had sort of experienced or suffered through about 3 years of fruitless dating. And right around the time I was turning 30, my father started to, he tripped upon these matrimonial websites, these Indian matrimonial websites. They're quite popular, actually. Shadi.com is probably the most popular. Shadi meaning marriage. And he filled out my profile. And from there, you know, I just started, I agreed to go on these arranged marriage setups. But at the same time, I was dating normal, you know, free-for-all New York style. I mean, what you've seen on TV or immortalized in books and all of that, in pop culture. So it was this very unlikely balance. And I wrote about it for New York Magazine. And that was an article that did very well. And I was approached to write a book, and I decided to take the book to India. I thought the real story was unfolding there. More than half the country is under 30. Some estimates as high as 65%. So I thought it would be a very interesting combination to both transfer my search there for husband and love and also to write about the new India in an anecdotal way that I did not see India being written about in that way.
Mm. Anita Jain is author of Marrying Anita, A Quest for Love in the New India. She was partly raised in Sacramento, although she lives in Delhi. She's visiting her parents in Antelope. What did you think of arranged marriage when you were growing up in the U.S., the daughter of Indian parents?
Well, certainly it was something I never thought I would do myself. And in that sense, in the very traditional, strict sense of the word, it's something that still happens in the vast majority. The vast majority of the country still uses arranged marriage in the sense that a couple will meet for maybe 5 minutes and then they will marry. Now, I didn't think I would have any kind of arranged marriage, but certainly even the book isn't about that kind of arranged marriage. But it is about trying to use more traditional methods. I describe my going out on to meet men with my parents, which left me deeply uncomfortable, and which I write about. And I'm not opposed to the idea of meeting somebody with the intention to marry, obviously quite soon, in an accelerated way, if we get along. And that, of course, I'd like to know them for a couple of months. But I've never been of the mindset that you need to know someone in this open-ended way for years and years and years before you decide that they're the right person.
You write in your book about the quote-unquote New India. What are those young people who are doing well, living this life in India, what do they think about the more traditional ways to get married in India, including but not just arranged marriage?
Right. Well, it's a very interesting time because the country is in flux. So you have this very urban culture that that kids are growing up in, and tradition is rapidly falling by the wayside. So I do describe this bar hopping and bed hopping, if you will, which did come as a surprise to me, not the fact that it was happening, but the fact, the extent and depth to which it was happening came as a real surprise. But that said, I've also read studies that say the vast majority of urban youth still support arranged marriage. So it's a very interesting time where so much is in flux, but yet people might, you know, revert back to the old ways when dealing with this very important question.
Your own parents' marriage was arranged, wasn't it?
Oh, certainly. They only saw each other once, and they're very happily married. They've been happily married for 40 years. So if I could replicate that, I would be very, I'd be thrilled.
What's their secret?
I think it's mutual respect and a desire to make things, you know, it's mutual respect is what it is, and a desire to make things work. I think it's the actual desire to make it work.
Do you think that mutual respect and the desire to make things work is in any way a product of the fact that their marriage was arranged?
I certainly think so, and even the New York Times review at the end sort of discusses how that my real question may be, is modernization really progress? I certainly think that I wrote the book, while it is about India and while it's about an Indian woman, it's also about a very universal thing that I see happening all over the world, which is I'm in my mid-30s. I have friends all over the world in their mid-30s, that many of whom are not married. And so you have to ask yourself, if women have made all these advances, and I don't have the answers, Jeffrey, but if they've made all these advances in the workplace, professionally, financially, and they no longer need men to support them, why do they seem to have taken a step backwards in this other way? And I don't blame it entirely on women or on men. I just think that we really need to examine the choices that we make in the modern world.
Anita Jain is author of Marrying Anita, A Quest for Love in the New India. She was partly raised in Sacramento, although was born in New Delhi in 1973. You spent most of your young life in the United States, but you are Indian by birth. You live in India nowadays.
Yeah, certainly. I came to the U.S. when I was 6 months. So, yeah. But from the age of 11, I've lived in Sacramento. So I went to El Camino High School and Churchill Junior High, if you know those.
Yes, indeed. How American do you consider yourself, and how Indian do you consider yourself, and how does your personality split, if it does?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I do discuss that in the book. When I'm in India, I feel very American, and when I'm here, I feel at a remove from American culture. I mean, not completely at a remove, but certainly that I have something else going on, if you will.
Yes.
And so it becomes, people who have this kind of dual identity, I think that's probably a common theme running through their lives.
Well, now you spend a lot of your time nowadays in India, but your parents still live here. How American have they become?
Oh, Jeffrey, they couldn't live in India now.
Really?
They love to complain about it, how it's too dirty for them and things don't work and it's just not efficient, and I completely understand. I mean, India, as much as it's changing and has definitely linked up with the globalized world, they've liberalized the economy in the 1990s, it's still very much a third world country, and that's something I discuss in the book as well. That's going to take a long while to change.
Why did your family move to the United States, and why did they come to Sacramento?
My father first came to the U.S. for better opportunities, and I do discuss his move. And interestingly, I discuss how my journey was very parallel to his. He came at the age of 33, and I went back to India at the same age. So it's sort of a reverse journey. He came to the U.S. to seek out better economic opportunities. It was a very right now we're seeing a boom time in India. That certainly wasn't the case back then. It was a very dismal kind of post-independence India at the time, and there were hardly any private companies, and times were very tough then. So he came in the early 70s, and after a while, we ended up settling in Sacramento, and they really enjoyed living here. The weather's beautiful, and it seems to be close to everything. So, and they decided to stay on.
Do you ever wonder how your life would have turned out if your family had stayed in India and you had been raised Indian in India?
Oh, very much so, and I discuss that because I discuss, meeting cousins and wondering what my life would have been. I mean, I have cousins in the book that I describe in a chapter who got married at 21 or 22, and they're my age, and they just lead very hidebound lives where all they do is cook and clean, and they have to ask their mother-in-law for permission for everything they do, from taking off a bracelet to what to cook for dinner. And I do wonder. I mean, I don't think I could have lived that life, but I may have had to.
Mm.
It's a very interesting idea to think about that, and to think how much our culture really does shape us, as much as we like to think we are individuals.
And how do those cousins in India, what do they think about you? What do they think about the Americanisms that you have obviously adopted over the years? And what do they think about your decision to live in India today?
Well, I think that, the concept of America is, or the kind of freedoms I have is just beyond their ken of reality. And I actually talk about this in the book, which is that where they live is a mere hour or less from my own home in Delhi, but it's a completely different world because the urban centers are so very different from the vast majority of the country. So what you have going on in Delhi and Bombay or, Bangalore is just very different from the interior. I couldn't speak for them, but I think that it's inconceivable to them, perhaps, the kinds of freedoms that I might have.
Yes,
and they're probably wondering, why I've moved back. I suppose if I've enjoyed all these freedoms my entire life in the U.S.
Anita Jain, author of Marrying Anita: A Quest for Love in the New India. She was partly raised in Sacramento, but she lives in Delhi. She's visiting her parents in Antelope, but goes back to India quite soon. Anita Jain, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, why camels race every year in Virginia City. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. For nearly 50 years now, jockeys have raced camels in Virginia City. This annual competition is competed by a group called the International Order of Camel Jockeys. This year's races happened this weekend. Joining me is the president of the International Order of Camel Jockeys. He's Mike Wright. Mike, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What are camels doing in Virginia City?
They have no choice. They're just up there racing.
Do they live in Virginia City year-round?
No, there's several promoters that bring up, or several stock handlers that bring up animals to the races under contract each year. So it could be one of three right now.
But the camels have some kind of history or alleged history in Virginia City. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the history goes back to the 1800s when the cavalry was using the camels to haul stuff up the hill. It turned out that the camels don't get along with the cavalry people, the other horses, dogs, or anything. So they set them all free in the desert up there. And for many years, there was a herd of camels roaming around Nevada until the cowboys decided they started shooting at them.
And is this all true, or is this Mark Twain?
No, this is all true. In the 50s, a herd of the camels were pulled out of the desert and placed in Nevada's care, at which point in time there was 40 left somewhere around 1980, which our organization picked up and started caring for. They ended up here in Sacramento in the early 80s, and they just sort of stayed with us for quite a while.
Mike Wright is president of the International Order of Camel Jockeys, who compete in the annual Virginia City International Camel Races, which run this Friday through Sunday. On the phone is Brandy Lee, unofficial historian of the Virginia City Camel Races and a charter member since 1959 of the International Order of Camel Jockeys. Brandy, welcome to Insight.
Welcome.
Could you tell us how the races got started? It was a bit of a hoax at first, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Bob Richards, the editor of the Territorial Enterprise, 50 years ago, had nothing better to do one day, so he ran a story on camel racing and posted the results. Well, that was the end of it until the following year when a newspaper from San Francisco picked up on it and said, hey, we want to get in on these races. And through and through, they got camels up here. John Huston, who was in Nevada at the time.
The film director.
Right, correct. He was filming The Misfits with Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe. Well, he came up to Virginia City to race, and that's basically how they got started.
Had he ever ridden a camel before?
Never.
Had you ridden a camel before you started in the Virginia City camel races?
41 years ago, no.
Well,
I am the oldest racing camel jockey right now.
Well, tell us what it was like the first time you got up on top of the camel to ride it.
Well, you know, they say if you can ride a horse, you can race a camel. That's not true. You just get on and hang on. It's way up. You feel like you're in a skyscraper, and they've got a funny gait, and you just want to hang on. And it's really exciting. It's a lot of fun. It's different.
They're a very different shape from a horse. I mean, the shape of the back of the camel seems to me to conspire against being able to sit on it.
That's true. Sometimes we race in front of the hump and sometimes on top of the hump, depending on the contraption that they have on the camel for you to, you know, race like a saddle.
And which do you favor?
I prefer racing. Actually, it's the Australian saddles where they race behind the hump. And you've got a bit of padding and some stirrups, but everyone has their own way that they like to race.
I'm looking at a picture of a guy on a camel, and he seems to be sitting behind the hump. Looks to me like he's a long way from the head of the camel, which is what you're using to guide the camel. Does it seem like you're a long way from the camel?
Yes, you are, and hopefully you have long arms where you can hold on to the lead rope and hold on to someplace on the camel and race.
Yeah, Brandy Lee is unofficial historian of the Virginia City International Camel Races and a charter member of the International Order of Camel Jockeys. In our studio is Mike Wright, the president of the Order of Camel Jockeys. Mike, describe your technique for riding the camel.
Hang on for dear life and just get up there and have some fun. There's no way you can control who's going to win. There is no better camel than the other one. One time they'll race, one time they won't, and another time the other one that's not been racing will race.
Are they temperamental?
Very, yes. worse than all four of my wives put together.
How do you practice, if you do practice riding a camel?
Just get on and hang on. That's the fun part of it. You might win.
So you don't ride camels the rest of the time?
No.
And tell us
There's none in Sacramento to ride right now.
Yeah. Tell us how you get to be president of the International Order of Camel Jockeys. It's a prestigious title.
It was just one particular year where everybody was tied up and everything, and they elected me president. And since then, probably 1985 or 6, I think I've been president for a little bit over 20 years. Off and on. There's been two other presidents in between that, but that's it.
The annual Virginia City International Camel Races happen this weekend, Friday through Sunday, in, of course, Virginia City. Noel Young also joins us, who's a member of a three-generation camel racing family. Noel Young, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon.
How old were you when you first got on board a camel?
Well, just to ride around on them, I think I was 9. When I actually started racing, I was 16.
You started racing at 16, and have you been doing it since then?
Yep, ever since.
And are you the third generation or the second generation of camel racers?
Second. I spawned the third generation.
And who came before you? Who in the Young family?
You know, it's always nice in life when you can blame something on your mother and be right about it.
So she got you started with the camel racing?
She did.
Okay.
She was racing them in 73 and 74, and ever since then, we've all been involved.
You have another responsibility in connection with the camel racing, and that's Miss Candy's Girls at the weekend parade. Tell us about Miss Candy's Girls. Who are they?
It's a bunch of the women jockeys and the people that like to come but don't want to race. They just help out. We all dress up in Victorian era style underwear because during the heyday of Virginia City, it was where gentlemen miners went to entertain themselves in between shifts. And so we kind of pay attention and some tribute to that illustrious history by doing this. And we're a very popular parade float that goes down the street.
And do you have this year's Victorian underwear lined up?
Oh, yeah.
Brandy Lee, have you ever been part of Miss Candy's Girls?
Oh, sure, yeah. But it's kind of not fun getting in those corsets anymore, so I like to ride the camels instead.
She says that because I laced her.
Now, as Noel said, back in the day, Virginia City was a pretty rowdy place. Brandy, back in 1959, what was Virginia City like?
It was a ghost town coming out of being a ghost town into survival because of the TV series Bonanza. And then, of course, our different events, especially the camel races, puts it back on the map, and it gets wild up here.
I bet. Mike, although it's called the Virginia City International Camel Races, there are other species of creature. What else is there?
We have ostriches now. They used to race them in chariots. They used to race them with sulkies. And right now, they race them bareback. And usually 130, 150-pound individual get on and ride them bareback. The other thing is there's one of the stock providers brings up everything from water buffaloes to zebras.
Whoa.
And he also has a string of retired Brahma bulls that he brought to the Indio Date Festival one year, and we were looking at him trying to race them and figure out how we were going to do this, and we all backed out and let his handlers do it.
Have you ever raced on an ostrich?
No, I'm a little bit too heavy for that.
I see. Brandy, Noel, have you ever raced on anything other than a camel in the camel races?
Oh, absolutely.
Brandy first.
I've raced water buffalo, and I have a wonderful way of dismounting right over the horns. I've raced ostriches, which I will be racing this year, chariot style, and llamas.
Goodness me. And Noel, what about you?
Llamas and an ostrich once.
And what's your favorite?
Camels.
Brandy?
My favorite is ostriches because I used to be scared to death of them, loved the camels. But when you come off and break a collarbone and get a concussion, you kind of put your brakes on and think about it. And I sort of semi-retired, but I love the ostriches because it's a fun show, a fun ride.
Great. Well, that's the Virginia City International Camel Races with various kinds of creatures. The proceeds to the Eagle Valley Children's Home. Thanks very much to our guests in our studio, Mike Wright, who is the president of the International Order of Camel Jockeys. Brandy Lee is a charter member. She's been racing forever at the races. And Noel Young, a member of a three-generation camel racing family. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics in our show, go to our webpage, campradio.org/insight. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer is Robin Souza. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Developing vacant land near Sacramento's Capital City Freeway has proven impossible for many. On the next Insight, Phil Angelides tells you why he wants to try. You'll also hear from a neighborhood group that kept the last attempted development from happening. Also, a food scientist for Pesticide Action visits Sacramento to talk about world food issues. And we check in with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.